Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Over the last decade, competitive gaming has exploded in popularity. From sports games to fantasy adventures, young people have helped esports grow into a billion-dollar industry, and now it's viewed by hundreds of millions. But what does that world look like? And what does its growth mean for the future of sport in America? This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Today, we're listening back to an episode about how video games are changing our world. Later, we'll speak with a climate activist on how both video game players and the companies who create those games are affecting our environment. And what can we do about it? But first, across the nation, colleges are responding to the demand for gaming from students. According to the National Association of Collegiate Esports, nearly 200 colleges and universities now field competitive esports teams. In Connecticut, the University of New Haven has established an academic esports program and a varsity esports team. Jason Chung is assistant professor and executive director of esport business programs at the University of New Haven. Corey Parks is director of esports and head coach of the college's esports team. He's also a former pro esports player. Jason and Corey, welcome to Disrupted.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Jason, I want to start with you because before we get into the details of New Haven esports, I want to clarify for our listeners what esports actually looks like. I think that for many people, especially older listeners, they may assume this is about a bunch of kids in their basement playing Xbox or playing other video games. But this is a much bigger endeavor. So talk to us. What are some of the big esports leagues and what is esports all about?
Well, esports at its core is competitive video gaming, right? And people might think that people are in basement playing this kind of stuff. And of course they are. But on the professional scale, this is a full-blown activity. This is a full-blown league. This is a full-blown entertainment industry segment. And so as Corey will tell you, there are professional athletes that are signed to teams. They will be competing against each other in major invitationals and major tournaments throughout the world. You know, sometimes they're organized in league structures, sometimes in tournament structures. But at the end of the day, it's a multi-billion dollar business and with viewership over half a billion people across the world.
How old is this as an endeavor, esports? And what makes this different from how most people think about the game and sports?
Yeah, you know, esports has been around, you know, arguably for like, I want to say 15 years, arguably 20, I guess. But, you know, before the more recent blow up of esports, it was a single player named Fatality for the most part, who was really well known across multiple games, across multiple years in the StarCraft game to play. I mean, the timeline is not important, but it's been around for years, but kind of not in the spotlight, right? And then we kind of established that there's like intangibles connected to everything. And, you know, people are actually watching this. So we had that huge rise in the last like 4 or 5 years as to what we can do with this because it's not going away. I think, you know, there's a lot of stigmas that come with esports, right? I always just try to point out why it's so important not to go down that avenue. I think there's two things to gaming in general around esports. One is you're playing video games for a form of escapism with friends and socializing, which is fine. And it's been around will be around for years and has been. Esports is more dedicated towards the individual who likes to problem solve and critical think and then excel at it, right? And you want to be able to compete in a world where you might not, if you're not 6'5", you can still compete at a very high level, right? So there's no barriers of entry other than, do you have a brain, right? That's full stop. Other than, you know, we talk about the technical side where it's, you know, how much does it cost to get a good end computer? Technology obviously does have a barrier of entry, but when it comes to just the individual and what we're really focusing on, it's, do you like critical thinking? Do you like beating someone, you know, in a mental game? Can you work within a team environment to excel, right? So that's why esports is blown up, in my opinion. Anybody can kind of pick up a game and kind of do that naturally. Then you have me or someone else who kind of shows them you've been doing this for a long time, take it somewhere to the next level if you want to, right?
One of the things to also keep in mind is that the growth of esports generally has happened across the world at uneven rates. One of the things that always confuses people is about esports is that actually esports is not like football where it's one recognizable version of a game. There are multiple titles owned by different publishers. So obviously, when you're talking about an esports athlete, they could be playing wildly different titles, right? Everything from a first-person shooter like CSGO all the way to, basically simulation football in Madden, right? So, the definitions are different. And also in terms of the longevity of esports, in North America, I'd like to think we're still in toddlerhood. It's been around for a few years and it's continuing to grow. But in South Korea, for instance, it's a longstanding pursuit. One of the things that they had over there were PC bangs or PC rooms where people can play video games against each other. Originally, it was intended to provide productivity services, but teenagers prefer playing video games instead. And that's been around since the 90s. And in fact, esports basically was birthed there, right? Because some of the people on the network side decided this would actually make a good spectator sport and teenagers seem to really love it. So they've been putting it on TV since and streaming it online since the late 1990s. So it's over a good 25 years or 20 to 25 years now.
I want to pick up on something that both of you mentioned, and that is how we view and conceptualize sports here in the U.S., as opposed to how other parts of the world. So in many ways, sport and sporting in the United States has become this sort of marker of physical ability or of masculinity. And it is this idea that you need to physically conquer something. But what both of you have mentioned has been about the mental skill, the intellectual agility that is required to not just participate, but to really be able to maneuver all of these different things, that there are different games, there are different levels of interaction. Do you see e-gaming as a way to sort of push back against that narrow notion of what constitutes sport? I'm thinking about the Olympics. And when skateboarding was introduced, people said, I don't know if that's sports. That's not really athleticism. Do you see gaming as a way of challenging some of those notions?
At first, I think when esports kind of started to get a little bit of a bubble and people were playing more often, there was a little bit of a pushback mentality. I've completely gone away from that. You can call esports whatever you want, a sport, not a sport. I don't care. I'm so not focused on that narrative anymore that it's basically, I just focus on what my students within this scenario or my team that I'm playing on are doing, right? Like let the noise do its thing. At the end of the day, sports will succeed for the rest of our lives. Like there's no doubt in my mind. Are numbers slowly trickling away into esports? Yes, you can go look at the data, right? More kids are playing games relative to going and playing basketball when they're in fifth grade. It's just fact. So that being said, I just focus on us, right? I think I've had that mentality with every single thing I've ever done when it comes to esports is the more you focus on you and your circle of team or people you're trying to influence, I just ignore the noise at this point.
Absolutely. And one of the other things to keep in mind, going back to your original question is it a leveler? Is it something that allows people from all over different abilities and all that to compete against each other? Absolutely it is, right? In fact, one of the things that I'm really glad to see is that most of the video game console makers as well as PC makers are starting to really hone in on accessibility gear as well, so that people from different physical abilities can play. And I think all of that is incredibly positive. Will that have will that help acceptance or bring people over? Again, as Corey said, I think that's a little bit secondary. People always ask me whether esports is a sport, and I say, well, what's a sport? And then they have a hard time describing what that is, because ultimately sport is a way to describe the industry, right? And the people put up different sort of definitions around it. And, also as a sport management professor, of course, I have to do that a little bit. But at the end of the day, it's an entertainment industry. And as long as there are viewers, as long as there's revenue, and as long as there are competitors, you have something of value. And it's all the entertainment industry.
Jason, let's talk about that barrier to entry and how we build around the possibilities of esports and of gaming. You are now leading an esports program, bachelor's and master's programs at the University of New Haven. Share with us what those programs look like and what was the motivation behind creating this at the University of New Haven?
We have a few different academic programs. So, you know, some of them are a little bit more business oriented. Some of them are a little bit more esports and gaming general focused, so that students can make their own focus in sort of that industry. And the reason why we did that is because at the end of the day, you know, competitors and high level play has been around, but, you know, the support structure is still being figured out, right? So as Corey will tell you, even in the collegiate space, where do you compete? Who do you compete with? Who controls the leagues? What's the infrastructure like? All that is being decided on literally a minute by minute basis, right? Every time we check, it's a little bit different. And the whole, it's like the NCAA turning itself around every couple of weeks, right? You know, so we need students and frankly, the industry needs workers that can actually navigate that. You know, everything from project management to product development to you know, coding, to even just writing the games themselves. You know, all of these are skills that are complementary, but are required in the industry. And one of the central frustrations of the industry is that they've been trying to find good workers for a long time, and they can find people that are passionate about the industry, and they can find people that are, you know, competent in other fields and come in and bring that knowledge. But, you know, honestly, at the end of the day, we're talking esports is an amalgamation of a few different industries, right? It's a union between sport and video games and technology. And having workers that can navigate all of that is very, very tricky. And in fact, you know, they've been burned so many times with workers that they're approaching me. They're talking to me about, hey, you know, how are your master's students? Can they actually, you know, help us with some programs? And they're getting interviews and they're doing internships at the, you know, top places for that, because there's a lot of supply of workers, but qualified workers, not as much.
Corey, I want to connect something that you said earlier to Jason just framing out for us these degree programs, because there will be critics who will say, why do we need a degree, or why should we have this at the college level? But what you've both mentioned is the way that it challenges people to think critically and analytically, to rely on themselves, but also participate in a team. And, you know, again, as someone in higher education, I know people want to know, what is the return on that investment? So even as you focus, Corey, on the people who are part of this community and really supporting your players and those who are in the sport, how do you respond to that question about the necessity of really meeting the needs and interests of young people so that we're able to create something bigger that will endure?
Yeah, you know, the reason why I moved to University of New Haven was their strong vision on connecting the two, right? And Jason and I, we've talked about this in length. It's an ecosystem, right? To where without the growth of the academics and education side, like, I don't think esports on the competitor side will be plateauing anytime soon, but why not speed that growth up, right? And that's a combination of having really, you know, people that are studying this space to bolster and lift up the teams, right? Because now we're talking about getting into psychology, social media management, the whole nine yards, right? End of the day, you always chalk it up to, are there people watching esports? Yes. So it's like, with that there, you know, there's gonna be a money inflow at some point. Well, if not some point now, right? And continue to grow. So I always just talk to people and tell them, you know, that want to get part of the academic, but also be part of the varsity team, is, hey, look, just start competing, right? Like, because if you get an inside look or a feel for what you're doing day to day with these athletes, like, or whatever you want to call them, players, students, whatever it is, you're going to have a really good idea of what all the companies and the orgs right now want, right? And so we can make that bridge. We can help push them over to the academic and vice versa, so that you have a little bit of combination of both and experience, because the big players in the space right now, they want both. They really do. And without having that experience on the varsity side, you're going to lack. And without having the education to back it up, you're going to lack as well, right? Unless you are the 1% of the 1% that are top competitors right now. And that gap is like, it's going like this, right? It's going bigger and bigger day by day. So you really have to be able to, you know, hedge your bets. And if you want to be in a space that's supporting education and competition, you want to be part of both, right? So.
And there are also a couple of major trends as well, right? I mean, first of all, you're seeing this growth, and you know, it's exciting, and people want professional management, but this growth is also on the back of, you know, obviously some millennials, but also Gen Z as well. And the one thing that we know in terms of the marketing aspect of it is that that segment of the population craves authenticity. So somebody coming in and not being authentic, not really caring, not understanding the space, they'll tolerate some of it, but not really for a long time, right? So importing people, like I'm sure, you know, there are people at say Target or Walmart that might understand spacing and the space and the distribution and merchandising and all that kind of stuff. But if they don't understand the space or don't adapt to it quickly, they're going to have problems. So the industry is actually coming to the point where, well, where is that organic supply of next generation of workers coming from? And so they're looking to programs like ours to really help fill that space.
When we return, we continue our conversation with Jason Chung and Corey Parks from the University of New Haven. They'll talk about how the esports industry is responding to questions about representation and accountability. And later, what does the growth of the gaming market mean for our environment? This is Disrupted. Stay with us. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Later in the show, a climate activist on how gamers can lessen their impact on the natural world. But now we continue our conversation with the leaders of the esports programs at the University of New Haven. Jason Chung is assistant professor and executive director of esport business programs. Corey Parks is director of esports and head coach of the varsity esports team. He's also a former pro esports player. Gaming has seen no shortage of scandals around sexism, harassment, bullying, and abuse that have pushed many women away. And while female esports fans and players have grown over the last decade, the esports industry still struggles to attract and keep them in the sport. I asked Jason how the university is working to make its programming more accessible to all students.
So the first thing I can say is that, just to be completely transparent here, does the gaming industry as a whole have a male dominance? And is that a problem? Yeah, absolutely. That's something that I think everyone is dealing with. In fact, the whole industry is dealing with right now, because it's not only a moral issue now, it's also a business issue, right? If you've been seeing all the things that have been happening at Activision Blizzard or other places, you're seeing a lot of pushback against, what, quite frankly, a lot of people call frat boy culture. And, that's affecting not only the people and the culture within the company, but also the perception of that company in the broader gaming space and broader society as well. So that's something that we at the collegiate space are obviously trying to deal with. And in fact, one of the things in the master's program that I can point to is that we brought on Dell Technologies as a partner to teach our diversity, equity, and inclusion course. And in fact, that was done with a business focus, right? Because at the end of the day, of course, we want to talk about it morally and say we've got to do better, but that connected with the business side is really what begets change. And so, we want to get to parity. We want to have as much representation as possible. All of that we recognize is a process as well, right? Because these kinds of things have been going on for so long and it's become entrenched to a certain degree, overcoming that is not, an overnight thing. It's not a snap. You have to keep working at it. And quite frankly, we'll do that on the academic side. I know we're doing that on the varsity side. And we're trying to recruit from as wide as possible, both students and players. And we're also working with the industry to try to attack that problem and make it better, right? And give people rationale. There's a lot of times when you bring in representation, and this has happened to me as before, being Asian, when people say, well, this is buzzword, right? Why don't we just have the most qualified worker? Well, and I always point out to senior executives and things like that and people that you don't know what you're missing if you don't have that in the room, right? So, these are the kinds of things that we're trying to attack from a business level. And I think there's a growing recognition of that, not just in gaming, obviously, but in broader society as well, that, hey, we've been missing a big chunk of not only qualified workers and people that can contribute to our organization, but also fans, consumers, people we can engage with. So there's been a lot of movement and, we'd like to think we're at the forefront of that.
And I'll piggyback off that because I'm really passionate about this one, right? Because if we were making an analogy, I would think of like, if you're going to war, right? Jason's taking care of all that in the war room where I'm on the front line, right? Because you have this infinite amount of, well, feels like infinite amount of individuals who are online, not filtered and don't really understand. And their parents probably have 1,000 stories about each one of them about what they're saying to their friends over a microphone, right? And this is the real problem is you have a combination of a toxic mentality that kind of just like is rampant right now, along with the fact that, you know, like, I think the gaming industry itself is cut down the middle 50-50 for females and males. Like that's how they like to chop it up. And the metrics are there on the casual side of gaming, right? On the competitive side, completely different. I would say 90% to 10%. I've thought about this for a long time and it really falls onto one thing. And it's, you have to get people involved into what we're talking about at a younger age correctly, right? I always talk about the stepping stones and the stepping, like you can't have, there's no esports camp at grade 5 or 6 or four to really establish and solidify some of these great concepts we have, which is be inclusive and, you know, work within a team and don't trash talk people, have good sportsmanship. And this isn't a form of toxic escapism. This is, if you want to get better at something, you know, you have to put in the time and be kind to people. And all those things are, you know, wrapped around all the things we're talking about right here. And it just, the number one thing is get people into a space with guidance quicker rather than later, and you'll see a huge growth and a community shine. We're not there right now because for the last 10 years, other than, I mean, the recent 5 has been great, but the 10, the 15 before that, gamers have been, you know, by themselves, isolated with no one watching them, just doing what they love, but there's always going to be bad actors in any space.
Yeah, I think the main word is accountability. You know, the thing about gaming, you know, as Corey mentioned, in terms of history, it's been very unaccountable. You're anonymous. You're talking and you're saying all kinds of crazy things until recently, a lot of these things weren't even monitored quite as well, you know, because the companies basically said, hey, we don't want to start regulating this because if we start regulating it, we're going to be responsible. So, you know, some of that is changing now, but the key is also accountability up and down the chain. So this, now that more students are becoming part of high school leagues and collegiate leagues and pro organizations, you know, some of the things that they, everything that they say in any forum will also be, they'll be accountable for that. And I think that will help the culture. But it's also, again, a process, right? Really, I also have to point out that a lot of the time when we're talking about problematic people, they're a percentage, but they're a very vocal minor percentage of it, right? They're the ones that will show up and say all kinds of crazy stuff just to rile you up because, frankly, they don't have anything else going on with them, right? That's the way we have to, you know, I think of it. And is it time to weed that out? Absolutely.
I think it's what makes gaming as a community such an important and powerful opportunity to see what's possible. When you combine authenticity with recognition and accountability, what is the creativity, the innovation, the possibility that comes out of those spaces so that it's not about saying, you know, listen, this doesn't exist, but recognizing it does exist and here is the possibility. One of the other possibilities that I think about in this space is streaming. And how the emphasis on streaming that we're seeing with, you know, major motion pictures and now in gaming could also change some of these dynamics. How important is video game streaming and sort of online gaming more broadly? How important is that to the work that you're both doing in the classroom, but also in competitive gaming with teams?
It's critical. I mean, at the end of the day, streaming and you know, broadcasting yourself and being, you know, and connecting with an audience worldwide, that's actually the lifeblood of promoting everything. There's a lot of personality in the space, and quite frankly, that's the thing that people are glomming onto. And one of the things I'd like to point out is that, as Corey knows as well, you know, professional teams and organizations, a lot of them are not making, they may have huge revenues, but profitability is always a concern. And in fact, it's something that they lose on a lot of the time. They just grow the asset. Whereas, you know, if you're a streamer, that's the profitable side of the industry right now, right? And you know, a lot of and why is that? It's because advertisers and sponsors are realizing that because new consumers want that sort of authenticity and crave that authenticity, they've realized that, hey, associating ourselves with these people is good for our bottom line. So how much stuff can we give them? How much money can we give them without, you know, it feeling, without making them look like a corporate shill, right? And so there's that constant, you know, communication going on. But yes, streamers are absolutely critical to growing everything because they're driving a lot of the viewership and the money. And how does that relate to esports? Well, you know, some esports athletes have followings as well, obviously, you know, culturally, it's very different about, you know, around the world who people will watch. In South Korea, for instance, you could have zero personality, but as long as you're really, really good, people will follow you. Whereas in North America, it's a little bit more personality focused. But again, these are marketing trends and things that are being figured out actively as we speak. And honestly, I think they're a pretty big lifeblood of everything we're doing, everything from the casual gaming side, but also the esports side as well.
Yeah, and I think it's really important because you just talked about accountability, right? And if I know one thing about people that compete and play and are in the space of esports is they're passionate, unfiltered, and you know they're going to make mistakes. And you know, I admire anybody who can be on Twitch day in, day out and be judged, critiqued nonstop. It's a very hard thing to do, so they deserve all the credit for and everything that comes to them. That being said, they have to be held accountable, right? And Twitch does an okay job at times, questionable, right? But at moments, I think they do a pretty well job overall, but they are the ones that the 14 or 13 year old Fortnite player is going to watch and try to act like, right? We talk about role models in the space too. And those are the first ones they kind of actively try to watch because first they'll start watching YouTube videos and they'll go find someone that they actually enjoy listening to. And that's a really defining moment because most parents don't really know how to stop a kid from picking what they're watching on Twitch most of the time, or unless they're really involved. And, you know, at that point, you're really setting themselves up for what the next 4, 5, 6, 7 years is going to be if they really like that entertainer. Right. So I think it's literally the forefront of how we hold people accountable within the space. We have some really good role models in it and not some that are not so great.
Jason, I grew up playing The Legend of Zelda and Duck Hunt and Super Mario Brothers, and I thought that made me a gamer. Clearly, it does not. It made me someone who loved games, but maybe it did make me a gamer. But as I think about where we are today and the future of esports and the possibility of esports, I think it's also something that the broader public needs to be more literate about. As we wrap our time together, what is one thing that you wish the general public knew about esports or about the enterprise overall?
I think the most important thing is not to treat esports as some alien thing, right? At the end, and you know, people like to poo-poo things that they don't understand. You know, there were, you know, quite frankly, even if you go back to the history of collegiate athletics, you know, football is not as old as people think. Hockey is not as old as people think, right? So I'm sure there are people back 120 years ago that were like, well, why should we do this? It's a movement away from what we're doing. So instead of being resistant to it, I would say, what about this really speaks to the next generation? Think about that, right? And, you know, I grew up the same as you playing those games. I think it makes both of us gamers, right? And at the end of the day, I never conceived myself having this position. This position actually, frankly, doesn't exist anywhere else, right? Which is why I'm here. And it's a career path, right? So if it has that kind of, you know, stickiness in society and people want to talk about it, I would encourage people not to think of it just as a, you know, a curiosity, but really say it's part of entertainment, whether we understand it or not. You know, just like, you know, 30 years ago, we had no idea, or 20 years ago, we had no idea what YouTube was, and now it dominates our lives. Maybe just think of this as the next evolution of entertainment, right? It's a little bit more interactive. It's a little bit younger. And frankly, the younger people will get older and then things will change again. But think of it as just a part of a evolutionary stream of entertainment. And that's what I think that people should think about.
And I'll add to that too, because you said, you know, maybe not a gamer. No, you absolutely are. Because, you know, I grew up playing a game called King's Quest that was basically a pixel point and click adventure game. That's how I started, right? Like it always starts with the most odd game. And then eventually you kind of just grow into, you know, you're a gamer. So everybody who plays any game, tic-tac-toe, whatever, that's the thing too, right? Like we talk about esports, we're talking about a cultural move within games. That's what this is. That is the, you know, the last 30, 40 years, like first back to where Pong started, and you see this wildfire of people that really can express themselves through video games. That being said, I will say that if there's one thing I wish people knew and realized within esports, is the amount of sacrifice you have to give or what you have to do to get to the top for the competitor side, right? This is maybe a little bit selfish of me because I'm a competitor, but it's like that cliche saying, it's only the tip of the iceberg. I think some esports players, to get where they're at, it's a more competitive field than I think than 95% of other sports at times. And they have to give up so much without even realizing it, right? Because at first it feels fun. It's great. It always is kind of fun. But man, the amount of things I missed, had to tell friends I couldn't go there, or, you know, couldn't make something because I had to be on with my team for 10 hours that day, like that, no one really realizes that. No one looks underneath the iceberg enough. And to all those gamers out there, like even younger to now, keep on gaming, keep on dreaming, don't let anyone hold you back. I want to express that full heartedly. No one's ever going to believe you at first until you start showcasing how good you are at it. That only comes with time commitment.
Yeah. And one last concluding thought is that at the end of the day, you know, people think about gaming and, you know, they think, oh, well, you know, it's what I did when I was a kid, or it's what I, you know, or what I do on my iPhone. And all of that counts. And it's actually the dominant form of entertainment in the world. That's the one thing that people don't seem to think about. Over $150 billion plus globally in terms of revenues, 4 times bigger than the global film industry. Gaming is huge. Esports, the competitive gaming side, is a small slice of that, you know, at a billion plus, but it's going to grow and grow because, hey, if you're the dominant entertainment source for the world, people are going to want to see the best in any endeavor. So it's you know, there's a long runway yet. So people might as well understand what it is.
You both have inspired me to pull out my old game console and get back into it. Jason Chung is assistant professor and executive director of esport business programs at the University of New Haven. And Corey Parks is director of esports and head coach of the University of New Haven esports team. He's also a former pro esports player. Jason and Corey, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
To learn more about the University of New Haven's esports programs and find resources on esports, you can visit our website at ctpublic.org/disrupted. After the break, we'll hear more about the gaming industry and how it contributes to the climate crisis and what gamers can do to lessen their impact. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Stay with us. Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean.
Reversing the effects of climate change is everyone's responsibility. And we fully support the UN's leadership in asking our industry to make sustainability commitments. Now, I grew up in a generation that was ignorant about climate change. The effect of that generation's ignorance is there for all of us to see. So I'm really happy for PlayStation to support Playing for the Planet in any way that we can. There are billions of gamers around the world, and I believe that games and gamers can be a force for social change and would love to see our global community unite to help our planet to survive and thrive for future generations.
That was Jim Ryan, CEO of Sony Interactive Entertainment and PlayStation. He was speaking at an event at the United Nations in 2019. PlayStation is one of many gaming companies that have committed to the UN's Playing for the Planet campaign. The UN works to educate gamers on their carbon footprint. But climate experts say the real change has to happen at the corporate level. Every year, U.S. gaming produces the equivalent CO2 emissions of 5 million cars. Gary Cook is the Global Climate Campaigns Director for the climate change advocacy organization, Stand.Earth. He's here to tell us more about what the gaming industry is doing to fight climate change and how gamers can make a real impact. Gary, welcome to Disrupted.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, during the pandemic, a lot of people have been trying to find ways to occupy their time or to have a break from the monotony of the day to day. And we've seen overall that video games have become one of the key ways that people have sought to have that kind of engagement. But what some people may not be aware of is the carbon footprint of gaming and the impact that it is having on our environment. What are some of the ways that you are seeing companies and gaming have an impact on our natural world?
Yeah, I think some people might be surprised that gaming has a significant environmental impact. It uses a lot of energy, especially as we get into games that are more focused online, very graphic intensive, very interactive, very many of those very beautiful games. That can take a lot of energy. So it becomes very important where the energy is coming from. If we're driving demand for energy that's contributing to climate change, that's a problem, and a problem that the gaming industry should take steps to try to make sure they're focused on less energy and also powered with renewable energy.
It seems that every few years, some new gaming console comes out that becomes the new hot ticket that people are willing to stand in line for hours for or just have to have. But I always wonder what becomes of the consoles that are being replaced. You know, do people continue to use them? Are they just being thrown away? And what the impact of that is on the kinds of concerns that you have. Can you speak to that, that sort of the nature of gaming consoles themselves?
Yes, I think, you know, if you're a gamer over the years, you'll be collecting a lot of different devices in your closet and your drawers. That's also an important piece of the environmental footprint of gaming, because if console designers and the people who are making the games that run on these consoles are really focused on how can they make sure we get another unit sale 3 years from now, rather than, hey, let's let our customers, let's figure out how to let them upgrade their device. Let that investment, their own investment, the investment of the planet continue to live, and we'll allow them to not start over from scratch. That's a big problem, because that's a lot of what the system we have now is. It's very linear. It's make it, use it, throw it out, and start over from the beginning, rather than thinking about, okay, hey, we could actually design these things in a way that, hey, we could sell you a way to upgrade that. And it's totally possible. And other, some game designers are doing better than others than allowing users to repair their devices. That's really important. There's also decisions from a game manufacturer, like where is that manufacturing happening? And what energy is behind that? A lot of times it's made in parts of the world that are very heavily reliant on coal still. And that's clearly one way they could make decisions that would make it less. So it's about where it's made. And it's also make that investment last longer, because it's not just your money, it's the planet's investment as well.
I'm hearing, Gary, a connection between the ethical impact of gaming or the production of gaming, as well as the environmental impact. I don't think it's possible to separate the two, but the ethical question comes up in a variety of ways. And I think often for the public, they think of the ethics of it in terms of how much these consoles cost, right? Everyone wanted the PlayStation 5 last year, and people thought about the cost of that, or if it goes onto a resale market, how that increases. But as you're saying, it's also the cost of the production, and then who bears the disparate impact of that cost. How do we sort of change the conversation so that as people are engaging in this, as consumers, we're also thinking about the cost of this sort of entertainment and pleasure for us?
Yeah, well, I do think consumers are going to be the real catalyst for change here, because I think you see UN saying we are on a path to runaway climate change, and we're not reducing fossil fuels fast enough. People are concerned about the impact of their decisions on people in other parts of the world, and I think you're just seeing the game industry begin to wake up to the fact that they have a responsibility. Companies are starting to indicate they want to do better. They're definitely not moving at the speed and scale they need to. They're growing very quickly. We saw, gaming explode during the pandemic, and we need a much bigger intervention. I think that intervention needs to come in part from their customers, who want to say, hey, we like your product, but we don't want to be contributing to climate change. We don't want to be causing pollution as a part of our buying the latest Xbox platform.
So that intervention can come from consumers and from consumer demand. Do you think that there needs to be more of an intervention or more regulation from government? Or do you think that takes away from the sort of shared ownership of our environment and what we all collectively can do to address that?
No, I think we definitely need intervention from government. And you've had this already. And I think we need to see accelerate in terms of setting energy performance standards for consoles. You see that happen in California, where gaming is already like, it's like 5% of residential electricity demand. It's not kind of up there with electric dryers and other things that we otherwise think as being really big sources of household energy demand, electricity demand. And that's just from the console side. That's not even counting when you layer in the move to cloud gaming, which typically increases the amount of energy investment, you know, 2 to 3 times versus if you're just running it sort of from your own platform.
Let's talk about that then. First of all, I'm still stuck on the idea of the level of energy consumption for California related to gaming. And I'm thinking about when we get into these periods, especially in the summer, where people say, you know, don't run your washer and dryer during the day, or hold off on the dishwasher and do it by hand in order to conserve energy. I never hear those same demands when it comes to gaming. But a lot of people, Gary, thought that cloud gaming would be better because the barrier to entry in that space would be lower, that it would allow more people to participate. But it sounds like what you're saying is that cloud gaming can actually introduce even more demands or even more challenges when it comes to this environmental impact. Talk to us more about how cloud gaming functions in this space.
So cloud gaming, you know, you're basically taking what had previously been, you know, driven from your console and taking a significant port or adding an additional layer of computing graphic and putting it in the cloud. And so that's being, you know, there's energy spent in the data centers that deliver that. It's not happening on your Xbox now. It's all happening in the cloud. And it's also the energy spent getting that those bits and all the images between the data center and your house. So it's, you know, effectively, while your energy bill might be a little bit less if you're running cloud gaming because your own console wasn't working as hard as it's happening in the data center, you know, if you were able to look behind the wall, you'd have the equivalent of like another refrigerator to electricity demand happening to deliver that game to you. It underscores the importance of trajectory of the sector. And also, like, it's really important for those who are building cloud platforms to make sure they're doing it with energy sources that are not contributing to climate change. So focused on making sure that it's about building the infrastructure to power with renewable energy. It's also about designing games in a way that use less energy. I mean, and I think we also need to have some rationalization about how important is it to go to like a 4K gaming platform, which is much more energy intensive simply because of its size. The bigger you get graphically or data wise, it uses more energy. So if you have a 4K gaming platform that uses 15 gigabytes an hour, that's twice that of a Netflix movie. So it's, which is already, you know, has its own footprint. So just because we can doesn't mean we should. And I think it's an excellent point you bring up in California. We're getting these alerts all the time, certain parts of the year. It's like, we need to dial back our energy use. Gaming is never part of the mix, but it's certainly driving demand.
I'm fascinated by all of the dimensions of this, that we think about the energy use. We think about what it means to sort of displace those provisions. But one of the other things, Gary, that I think most people don't realize is the role of water and the usage of water to cool some of these centers and how that also can deplete precious, valuable energy sources that can have a lasting effect. How does water usage play into what's happening here?
Water usage comes mainly in the data center, where you're having big, like Walmart-sized boxes of basically Walmart-sized building full of small boxes of computers that uses a lot of energy. It generates a lot of heat, and you have to keep that equipment cool. And so that often, you know, it depends on how you build the data center. A lot of that can be very water intensive. And if you put that data center somewhere in the West, particularly right now, where we're all very water scarce, that can have a significant impact on water demand. So choosing, you know, part of what the responsibility of, you know, the Googles of the world and others who are building this infrastructure is make sure you're building data centers in places that aren't water scarce, and also designing your data centers in a way that are much less water demanding. And it's possible to do that. You see more and more companies focusing on that, but a lot of them aren't. And that as they're coming into town and building data centers, and before the community knows it, they've sewn up a lot of water rights that there was no discussion whether we wanted to, you know, give away a big chunk of water rights to a large internet company. And does that make sense in terms of the water needs of the community?
The challenge related to that in terms of the water needs of the community, the sense of community awareness and engagement, because as you said, often these decisions are made and by the time they become public, it's a done deal. And then the community is left to shoulder the impact of that. But it also raises this point that gaming is such a competitive industry, not in terms of the players, but the sort of the business of it. It is so competitive. It is changing so much and so often that it raises the question of whether the companies have the time, the motivation or the time to consider these ethical dimensions because they're just trying to keep pace with their competitor and push out to the fastest game or the, you know, the greatest graphics to do that. Do you feel like these ethical considerations are there, or do you think it is the nature of the industry that it is really about the bottom line, which is often money?
Look, I mean, the dynamic you describe is true for capitalism. Broadly speaking, it's about, you know, trying to make sure what you're reporting to your investors, what the next quarter, it's not about the long-term impact of your product. But that's changing too in investor community, like there are people who are moving their money. So you see a lot of the motivation for how companies are, you know, taking on climate change and other environmental threats because their investors are sort of saying, we're not going to invest in things that are driving climate change. So that becomes an important audience. I think the challenge for the gaming industry is like, they are in a race and they're trying to, you know, get out the next product and you don't have enough leadership and they're not being demanding enough. If you look at things like the Playing for Change initiative that was, you know, set up by the UN, it's a complete disconnect from what the rest of the UN is saying, like the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change saying we're in a crisis. We have to move very quickly. The Playing for Change thing is, you know, it's very soft, very slow, and not ambitious for the gaming industry. And we need to see companies step up and say, we want to be renewably powered. We're going to take responsibility for reporting what our pollution is. And we're going to show you how we're going to make it go down. Because that's what leadership would look like. And not find things like offsets or things that might make them feel good, but don't actually change, have any impact on their product.
We're in this sort of dual space where gaming is becoming increasingly popular or is very popular with younger people. And at the same time, younger people are often more attuned to the environmental impact of their choices. They are often more concerned with how their individual choices can affect our world, not just today, but in the years and decades to come. But for gamers, particularly younger gamers who say, look, I enjoy this, but I don't want my enjoyment to come at the expense of the environment. What's the advice that you give, Gary, to people who want to be more ethical and more considerate in their gaming practices?
I think it starts becoming more demanding, ask questions of the companies they're gaming on. We've seen it time and time again. These companies will respond to demands of their customers. You know, 10 years ago, I was working for Greenpeace at the time, we started a campaign challenging Facebook to unfriend coal because people didn't want their status updates, their photos, everything to be driving demand for dirty energy. And Facebook heard from their customers and they responded. And we've seen that happen many other times. So I think being demanding and rewarding those companies who are actually taking action. Companies care. They're spending a lot of money to attract their customers. They want to keep them. They're now listening to their investors. So I think investors will be paying attention if companies are not taking action because they see the risk both from climate change and from losing market share because customers are leaving to go game on other platforms.
I think it's an important reminder of the power of harnessing that energy of consumers who really can play a role in this. Gary Cook is the Global Climate Campaigns Director for the climate change advocacy organization, Stand.Earth. Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Disrupted is produced by James Scoble-Wolf, Shekinah Collier, and Katie Tularski. Special thanks to Meg Fitzgerald for all of her help this week. And you can find more episodes of our show by subscribing wherever you get your podcast. Just search for Disrupted and Connecticut Public. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. We'll be back next week.